Thank you very much. Thank you. I really loved so much of what you said, Mimi, and I'm kind of stopped after listening to Zoya. I kind of like I haven't really gotten past there yet. I want to thank Sonali so much for organizing this night and for not letting Afghanistan disappear from the consciousness of Americans. I mean, really. I want to just talk a little bit about Zoya because Zoya. I adopted Zoya in the year 2000, and she has subsequently been my daughter, but she's also been my great teacher and great inspiration. And I met her, we were just talking about this today, when I first went to Afghanistan under the Taliban in 1999. It was actually 99 that I met her. And she and another member of RAWA came to a hotel in Pakistan where they interviewed me and another woman I was with who were going to go in with them into Afghanistan. We were kind of drilled to see if we were not the CIA or FBI or somebody else. I know that's what was really going on, even though she claims it wasn't. And I remember sitting at that table and, you know, I was more terrified than I think than I was of New York critics. Do you know what I mean? Just to be sitting and being, like, judged and being listened to. And I thought, I'm going to blow this. I'm going to blow this interview. I've come all the way to Pakistan, and they're not going to let me come with them, you know? And I was trying to think, what was the magic ingredient? Like, what could I say? But what happened over the course of the discussion is that Zoya, with her deep, deep, deep brown eyes, just melted my heart. And I fell in love with her. And not only was I moved by her brilliance and her kind of extraordinary clarity of purpose and mission, but I was absolutely devastated by her heart and what she has lived through and what she has suffered and what she has survived and what she has managed to transform into direct and powerful political action. You know, we have an expression in V-Day, which is a global movement to end violence against women. We call men and women who have suffered enormous violence, who have suffered that violence or witnessed that violence, and rather than getting an AK-47 or a weapon of mass destruction, they actually grieve that violence, they feel that violence, and they allow that to then transform something within them so they are compelled to devote their lives to making sure it doesn't happen to anyone else. We call those people vagina warriors. And although I have not been able to perform the play yet in Afghanistan, I think that Zoya epitomizes what a vagina warrior is, because she has known suffering probably none of us will ever know, or hopefully will never know in this lifetime. And yet every morning she gets up and flies here, and whether she's sick or debilitated or depressed or sitting with more suffering than we know, and she keeps going and redirecting it to lifting and saving her people. And I just want to honor that from the bottom of my heart, Zoya. You know, I was thinking there are so many things I wanted to say or could say, or and a lot got said tonight. But one of the things I've been thinking a lot about, having just finished this book and started this tour 2 days ago. It just came out. I'm very, 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 very despaired right now about what's going on in America, to the point where I think that if we all do not start speaking in a deeper voice and having a greater passion and being more bold and more outrageous, I'm very scared we are not going to turn this tide back. And I think one of the things that I've really struck with, you know, I was on the phone this morning with an extraordinary woman named Sarah Chase. For those of you who don't know who she is, she's a woman who used to be a reporter at NPR, and several years ago she went to Afghanistan and decided she would essentially move there, and she moved to Kandahar, and she started an NGO, and she's been working on the ground in incredible ways. And I'm very proud that V-Day is supporting her efforts. They started this extraordinary little plant where they got a machine to take roses and turn it into soap, and it's now becoming this incredible economic boom in the community. But she's also been reporting and sending information back, and this morning we were talking about the fact that in Kandahar today, the Taliban is so back and so on the rise and so ever-present that 90% of people, and she said actually it's gone up to 99%, of people in Kandahar actually believe that the U.S. government and the Taliban are in cahoots. Okay, that is an extraordinary idea. That is an extraordinary idea. When this war began, we were told over and over and over that the purpose of the war was to liberate Afghanistan and liberate women. Let's just begin with that idea, to liberate women. Now, I, call me cynical, I never really understood why the Bush administration would be driven to liberate Afghan women than when they had never been driven to liberate their own. There was always a huge question. But I thought, let's give them, well, I actually didn't say let's give them the benefit of the doubt. I was highly distrustful. What we've seen now, and I think one of the things that I think this book is looking at, you know, let's just think about security, you know. How often do we hear this word now? How often do we say it all the time? Security watch, security clearance, security check, security, security, security. We've become a country that is actually obsessed with security. What is that? What is that? And I started to think when I began this book, why in the middle of this obsession have I never felt more insecure? Why, when the country is spending billions and billions of dollars on so-called security, have I never felt more afraid on the uber level? And I think part of what I've seen and part of what the book is addressing is that in this quest for uber security, or in the use of the quest which the government used to manipulate us and direct us and control us, we have actually made the world 20 times more insecure. I think Afghanistan is actually the perfect example of that. Because in the name of liberating women and freeing the Afghan people, we launched this war, we launched billions of dollars, we bombed, we dropped Scud missiles, we dropped bombs, we just exploded, we destroyed. But we didn't have a plan, we didn't have a strategy, we didn't have a vision, and we fundamentally didn't care about the Afghan people. You cannot launch wars and drop bombs and believe for a second that if your concern is not the people themselves, anything will ever change. Right now, we are essentially a military democracy. By that I mean that the basis of our government, financially, economically, spiritually, politically, is military. We spend $390 billion a year in this country on defense, and that does not include the indirect spending, nor does it include the Iraqi war. 1/6 of that budget, 1/6, I just want to say 1/6, would feed, provide drinkable water, educate, and put a dent in AIDS for the entire world for a year. A year! 1/6 of that budget. Now, please do not tell me that wouldn't eradicate the fertile ground of terrorism. To me, that is one of those logical, clear, obvious things. You know, in thinking about Afghanistan today, and when I went there, I was going to read stuff from the book about Afghanistan, but I'm going to read the last chapter instead. But I just want to say, when I first met Zoya and I went to Afghanistan, you know, I thought I understood misogyny. I really thought I had a grasp of sexism. I spent a lot of my life thinking about the oppression of women and violence towards women and domination of women. But when I went to Afghanistan, I understood for the first time what misogyny actually looks like when it has fully realized itself, when it has managed to completely congeal in taking and eradicating rights of women solely and completely. When I came back from that trip, and I want to say during that trip we had incredible adventures and incredible times, and I just want to tell two quick stories, one of which is that my father was involved in the ice cream business, and so when I heard before I went to Afghanistan that women in Afghanistan were not allowed to eat ice cream because it was perceived as lascivious and sexual, I became obsessed with this idea. And I couldn't. And I was in Moscow before I went there the night before, and I was eating bowls of ice cream. And I was trying to figure out why, and then I realized I wasn't going to be allowed to eat it in Afghanistan. Not that I even liked ice cream, but I just had to know I could eat it. And when I got there, I went through Afghanistan with a wonderful woman. And I kept talking about it to the point where I drove her mad. And finally she said, all right, we're going to take you to the secret ice cream eating place for women. And this had come on the heels of staying in the Taliban hotel in Jalalabad, where outside they had a sign which said, leave your machine guns and your hand grenades. It had a big X outside. And this had come on the heels of sitting with women who were having epileptic fits because they had been documenting the atrocities of women being murdered in stadiums and shot for doing things like flirting. And this had come on the heels of spending time in schools, clandestine schools throughout Afghanistan and Pakistan that Rawa was leading, where women literally risked their lives for teaching young girls the alphabet. And we finally went to this bazaar, and it was this little bazaar in Jalalabad, and we walked in and we got ushered into the back room, and we sat down at this table and they pulled these four sheets around us. And as we sat there, the woman I was with lifted up her burqa and they delivered the bowls of ice cream and she ate the ice cream. And I have to tell you, in that moment, I wept. And I wept for two reasons. I wept because I was in a place in the year 2000 or the 1999 where there was a place in the world where women were not allowed to eat ice cream. And I wept because women had figured out how to still keep eating ice cream. And that's what we do over and over and over. When I left Afghanistan on that trip, we were driving out, and, you know, it had been a very, very rough time, and I did not know that we were really even going to get out of Afghanistan. And I'm very claustrophobic, and I had a hard time wearing the burqa because I, having been a person who was very abused, I can't be in shut down quarters. So I was wearing a little scarf over my head because going under it made me so anxious. So I can imagine what women living under those conditions feel who have been traumatized out of their mind and then have to put a burqa on their head without choice. And we were driving out of Afghanistan, and one of the members of the committee on preventing vice and celebrating virtue pulled me over on the side of the road, and he had our car over, and he was screaming and whatever. And we had this wonderful driver who he started screaming at because our driver didn't have a beard that was the appropriate length. Your beard had to be, what is it, was it 5 inches to show that you were a member of the Taliban, and he had no beard because he was Pakistani. So we got pulled over to the side of the road, and my driver just kept saying, no, 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 it's fine. Mohammed said we could come. Mohammed said, and the guy said, who's Mohammed? And it was just like this crazy conversation. And then the Taliban member, who was very huge and very scary, realized that I wasn't wearing a burqa. And he said, you out of the car. And he had this long flogger. He had a paddle that had long, long leather at the end of it, and he was waving it, screaming to me, you have to get out of the car, get out of the car, get out of the car. I didn't get out of the car. But in that moment, again, I understood for just a brief second, just a slight second, what it must feel like for Afghan women to be walking through the streets of any city, any town in Afghanistan any day, where someone can pull you over, and if you're eating ice cream or flirting or talking or not wearing white socks or talking to a bird or listening to music, they can pull out that flogger and they can beat you senseless. And most of the women I met up to that point had, you know, welts and bruises all over their ankles from those floggers. When we got out of Afghanistan and I came home to America, I wrote a piece and I documented what had happened in Afghanistan, and I brought it to everybody I knew. I also had a video that Rawa had given me of a woman who gets taken into a stadium in a burqa, and she gets brought out into the middle of the stadium, and an AK-47 is held to her head and she gets shot. And she got shot because she was accused of flirting. I bought the video and I bought my article to just about every TV station, every magazine, every newspaper, and everybody rejected me except for Marie Claire, and they published my article. Well, that videotape was the videotape that got shown after 9/11 on CNN over and over and over. But the reason I was rejected at all those magazines and all those newspapers was because they said to me no one was interested in Afghan women and it didn't have anything to do with our security. I tell this story because I think we're here all over again. I think we're here all over again. We are not talking about Afghanistan. We are not talking about what's going on in Afghanistan. We are not talking about the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan. We are not talking about the fact that warlords, I mean, this particularly American regime seems to export military democracy. And what it looks like is this. It looks like corrupt government. It looks like stolen elections. It looks like a total investment in bombs and military ammunitions at the complete expense of human security, and that means people being fed, being protected from diseases, not being beaten in their homes. We can go down the list. This is the democracy, so-called, that we are exporting. We are now in a country that has not only done this in Afghanistan, but has created a worse situation, actually, in Iraq. And we are talking to ourselves about security. I want to read this chapter and I want to close, but I want to say something about RAWA. You know, VIDA has been supporting RAWA as long as we can since I met Zoya. Groups like RAWA do not compromise. Every single bit of the way in this journey, they have stood up and they have told the truth, much to their danger and much to their people attacking them and putting them down. But they have told the truth. They have said that if warlords remain in power, there will be no justice, there will be no freedom, there will be no security in Afghanistan. They have said, if we do not change things from the bottom up and empower women and give them money and give them resources, they will never be able to be educated or turn their lives around. Every single thing they have said has come to be true. We need to support them because they are the truth carriers of Afghanistan. They are the people putting out the true message that if we are willing to hear it, we could actually be impacted in a way where we might do the right work and the good work to liberate the women and people of Afghanistan and feed them and clothe them and support them and nurture them so that the fertile ground of terrorism would not be sustained. I'm going to read the conclusion of the book. It's called Peace is a State of Being, Security is Being of the State. The law of security goes something like this. It is almost a guarantee that in the pursuit of security, you will become more insecure. Inherent in the quest for security is its undoing. Some recent examples: bomb Iraq to get rid of theoretical terrorists and manufacture thousands of potential terrorists in the process. Send American soldiers into battle to make Iraq secure, but refuse to spend any money on armor to make the soldiers secure so that 80% of those who receive upper body wounds die of injuries that could have been prevented. Declare war on Iraq to get rid of chemical weapons and end up using illegal chemical weapons, incendiary devices that destroy the children you are saving. Secure democracy by using techniques of torture that not only thoroughly undermine democracy, but spread distrust, contempt, rage, and violence, which will forever make democracy impossible. In securing freedom, rob citizens everywhere of their basic civil rights. Imprison them without trial or recourse. Hold them for as long as you like without charging them. Put them in invisible prisons in countries you once claimed were responsible for gulags. Wiretap private citizens without a warrant, and by doing so, expand presidential powers so they become imperial powers and strip the so-called democracy you were protecting. Promise to liberate women through your invasion and occupation, and in the process, reverse their constitutional rights. Rob them of protection, raise the levels of violence permitted towards them. Spend all of your money on security and end up with the hugest deficit ever. No health care for the majority of citizens, no protection against disasters, no vaccines. Make the world secure by spending all of your money on destroying things rather than creating. Bomb rather than build. Annihilate rather than feed. Focus your attention on imagined enemies who must be controlled or destroyed, and in the process, guarantee they will become your enemies. In securing people, make them really, really afraid. Create all kinds of colors and alerts that terrorize the population. Terror and numbness will eventually be mistaken for security. In securing people, take away all their opinions and voices and instincts, make them afraid to speak out. Control will eventually be mistaken for security. In securing people, distract them through addictive consumption and mindless entertainment, amnesia will eventually be mistaken for security. Freedom can only come from contemplating death, not pretending it doesn't exist. Not from running away from loss, but entering grief, surrendering to sorrow. Freedom comes not from holding your life more precious or sacred than others, not from consuming more than your share. Freedom is not knowing something when you don't know it. Freedom means I may not be identified with any one group, but I can visit and find myself in every group. Freedom does not mean I don't have values or beliefs, but it does mean I am not hardened around them. I do not use them as weapons. Freedom cannot be bought or arranged or made with bombs or guards. It is deeper. It is a process. It is the acute awareness that we are all utterly interdependent, The economic injustice and inequity creates an environment of global despair and rage that, until balance, will inevitably lead to hatred and violence. Freedom is not only being able to tolerate mystery, complexity, ambiguity, but hungering for them and only trusting a situation when they are present. Not owned, not occupied, not bought. Finding the place in me that connects with every person I meet rather than being different, better, or on top. Believing there is a power determining everything at the same moment I know there's absolutely no one in charge. Freedom is not knowing where you are, but being deeply there. Not waiting for someone to save or rescue you or make up for your terrible past, but doing that for yourself. Not putting your flag in the ground. Not only people or ideas being willing to get lost in the desert. Freedom is about becoming vulnerable to one another, rather than becoming secure, in control, and in charge. The increasing insecurity of the world can make us insane. Or it can simply clarify reality, which is that we are all going to die, and it could happen anytime, anywhere. The world is indeed a near-death experience, forcing us, if we let it, to let go of certain illusions that separate us from one another. Having this in our consciousness could be the elixir that makes us more feeling, more present, more appreciative, more loving, more generous. It is clear that the tactics of this current regime, retaliation, humiliation, and revenge, have actually increased terrorist attacks. But more importantly, most of the dying in this world, most of the suffering, is not a result of terrorism. The focus on terrorism has been one of the great manipulations and distortions. Most of the people of the world, particularly outside the U.S., live in perilous conditions. The greed-centered economic policies of multinational corporations, in partnership with the U.S. government, masquerading as our great protectors, cause worldwide starvation, the destruction of the environment, horrendous poverty, illness, illiteracy, the spreading of AIDS, and resulting violence. If we are truly interested in security, let's begin with securing all people the basic human right to food, shelter, drinkable water, health care, a place to live, safety, and a livable earth. Let's take the $250 billion that could ultimately be $1.3 trillion that it cost to bomb the heart out of Iraq, to murder the children there, to kill and maim thousands of people, to scatter ready-to-explode cluster bomblets on the Iraqi earth, to fill the bank accounts of CEOs at Halliburton and Bechtel. Let's take the money and make compassion the end goal. Human connection, the end goal. Honoring all people, the end goal. Then I promise, we may not know security, but we will definitely know peace.